as we inherit motivation. So it's very important, especially when doing activities that look like they have to do with the Dharma, to make sure that we have a motivation that has to do with the Dharma. In other words, that we're not just here because that's what you do on Friday night or Saturday morning, depending where you are. And we're not just here so we can listen to something and, you know, criticize it. We're not just here so that we can be with our friends, but we're here because we really want to learn the Buddha's teachings so that we can apply them to our lives. And we want to do that so that we can cease not only our own dukkha, our own unsatisfactory experiences, but also the dukkha of others. And why get involved with other people's problems? Don't we have enough of our own? Why do we need to get involved with theirs? Here we're involved with their problems in a healthy way, not in an unhealthy way, where we're being a busybody or taking responsibility for something that isn't our responsibility. But rather, here we're caring about others' situation because they're just like us. They want to be happy. They don't want to suffer. And they've been kind to us. So it just makes sense to do whatever we can to be a benefit to them. Especially aim for the highest awakening so we can be of the greatest benefit. And so let's make that our motivation. So it is an interesting thing to think about. Why do we want to help others? Because so often in regular life, our wish to help others can be infiltrated by some other kinds of thoughts, like, I want to know what's going on. What's the latest thing that's happening? You know, we're a busybody. We want to know what other people's business is. You know, just so we can, I don't know, have something else to think about or something else to talk about. But bodhisattvas aren't helping others because they want to know the latest gossip and be involved in the latest thing that's going on. Often, sometimes too, when the opportunity to benefit somebody comes, we're far away from being a busybody, and we're at the opposite end of the thing of like, I have enough problems, leave me alone. Yeah, can you grow up and handle your own problems already? Yeah, why are you dumping them on me? So that attitude also isn't very receptive to being of benefit or seeing other sentient beings there as a pain in the neck. And also we're coming up with many good reasons, not, you know, like, well, why should I help them? They don't listen to me anyway. Yeah, just forget it, let them do what they want, they'll learn from their own experience. Yeah. And so that basically is just laziness on our part. maybe tinged with anger or tinged with condescension. You know, there are some very good reasons for being of benefit to others. Yeah, we could go on and on and on. First of all, I mean, if we're going to become Buddhas, then we need to have the attitude to benefit others. So, you know, if you don't have that attitude, then forget about becoming a Buddha. So that's a real good reason to care about others. Yeah. But also, hey, if I'm miserable, don't I want somebody else to care about me? Yeah. So, if that's what I want, then that's what I should offer as well. And then, of course, thinking about the kindness that others have shown us already before, then it's not even a question of, if I want help in the future, shouldn't I do something for someone now? Because then they'll owe me a favor. Not thinking like that, but, you know, they've already helped me so much, so it's only natural that I extend myself. Okay? But we have to know how to help in the proper way. Yeah? And if we come in with an agenda of how we are going to benefit people and what they're going to do and be after we benefit them, yeah, then we're asking for trouble, okay? So bodhisattvas have to have very expansive minds, you know, and just be able to give without expectation of anything in return. Yeah, even thank you. Okay, so we try and cultivate that kind of wish to be of benefit, and then seeing that becoming a Buddha is the best way to be of benefit, then we generate the bodhicitta aspiring for Buddhahood. Okay, so now there's a bunch of questions. If you have things that you want me to read before I answer a question, if you could put those in my box, it would be great, because otherwise it's meditation time, and I'm the one who's making so much noise, because I have to read it if I'm going to answer, you know, if it's a whole sheet like this, I can think. Okay, so the first question is, okay. So it's in Bhatta Rinpoche's The Words of My Perfect Teacher. And so he's talking here about how the Buddha and different arhats still have to accept the effects of past karma. So, and then he's talking about the Buddha telling one story about, you know, there was a battle going on between one clan and the Sakyas. The Sakyas got massacred, and that day the Buddha had a headache. You know, so he was explaining why he had a headache was because of something he did in a previous life. And then also explaining why, you know, there's another occasion where the Buddha stepped on a splinter and he experienced pain. Okay, and where Shariputra, he was killed by somebody because of his actions, that he was a great arhat, so how could that happen? Okay, so here, in terms of the arhats have eliminated, well, they haven't eliminated, but the karma they have to take rebirth can no longer ripen. But they may have created other karma that could result in some kind of pain. Now, why would an arhat or a bodhisattva or a Buddha, why would any of them experience pain if they've already realized emptiness? Wouldn't they meditate on the emptiness of the pain and thereby overcome it? So Padma Rinpoche here is telling the story according to the Pali tradition. Okay? In the Pali tradition, it's saying that when an arhat is, you know, born, or also the Buddha when he was born, his aggregates, you know, his body and mind, were the products of ignorance. And so even though he attained awakening in that life, the body was still a polluted body, polluted meaning under the sway, under the influence of ignorance and the latencies of ignorance. And so they, in other words, that's what they would call nirvana with remainder, the remainder being the polluted body. And so they say that the Buddha experiences pain because he still has that kind of body, and that body, the nature of that kind of body, you know, is to experience pain. The Mahayana, on the other hand, say the Buddha was awakened many eons ago, and that what we see was more a it was a manifestation, an emanation body, and the Buddha appeared that way so that his whole life became a teaching for others. But of course, he didn't experience any pain because his body was not a polluted body. It was an emanation body of the Buddha. Okay? So the story's just been given from the perspective of the Pali tradition. Okay? Then, another question somebody asked about sometimes at home or at school or at work, you know, you need a tool or an appliance, and it's not real clear who owns it, or even if it's clear who owns it, the owner isn't around to ask. So what do you do? Okay, so one thing is, if you're working with a group of people, let's say in a workshop or a laboratory, and you're using a lot of each other's things, or you're using, well, if you're, the things are commonly owned, or if they belong to the school or the laboratory, then of course anybody who works there, goes to school there, can use them. But if it's more of a private thing with people's personal tools or appliances, and you know you're going to be working with them for a while, then just ask, hey, if I come in and I need to use something and you're not here, can I go ahead and borrow it? You know, so set it up with people beforehand. Or if you haven't done that and you're not taking it, you know, out of the room to another building or another location or something, then just use it, leave them a note, or even you have to take it into the next room, leave them a note. If it's somebody that you know wouldn't mind your borrowing the thing, yeah, if it's somebody who might mind, then, you know, don't use it. Okay? And then this person also said, apparently in their family, different family members, somebody has like a container that they really like, so it's put in the corner where all their things are, but the container holds salt and sugar, which you would assume are the whole family is eating. I assume if you're living with your family that things like salt and sugar are commonly owned property, and you don't need to ask about using them. You don't think so? Oh, specialty salt and specialty sugar.
Himalayan salt.
Okay, Himalayan salt. Okay, so if it's something you think that somebody's keeping just for themselves, then of course don't take it. But if it's something that there's the feeling in the family that is common property, even if the container they consider theirs is theirs, I would assume it's okay. You know, I remember one time, because I was really trying to be quite careful with this, and I was at my parents' house, and I was out of pens, and I asked my mom if I could keep a pen. And, you know, it was one of these cheap big pens, thick, you know, the bone. And she looked at me, she said, of course. Like, why are you bothering me with this? You know that you can, you know, take it. You know, in the family, these kind of things are just, everybody shares, you can take it. So I got from her response, like, if it's, you know, she really would prefer not to be bothered with me asking about small things. Can I use this or can I take it? When I know very well that in the family this is something that is commonly used or that they would happily give to me. Okay? So it's, you know, and if ever you're in doubt, like I stay at many people's houses, yeah? And some people, when I come to stay there, they say, make yourself at home, help yourself to the refrigerator, or, you know, whatever in the cupboard. So that's very clear. Other people don't say that. So then I don't go, you know, and look for things. But I know that I'm going to have a cup of tea in the morning, so I ask them, you know, can you show me how to make a cup of tea tonight? And then I'll make my own tea and I won't disturb you in the morning. And then you know, if they don't want me to have a cup of tea, I'm sure they would say, but they always show me how to do it, and then, you know, it's okay, but I don't go looking in their cupboards if they don't say anything, okay? Unless it's for a spoon or something, because I know that people would want me to use a spoon. okay. So I think that takes care of it. But it's always good, you know, if you're ever in doubt, then ask about it. You know, in the bathroom, when I stay in people's homes, I assume that, you know, if there's soap and hand lotion on the counter, whatever on the counter, or in the shower, you know, I assume it is freely offered. But things that are put away under, you know, under something or in a drawer, I would assume those are not freely offered. Now, I don't ask everybody whose house I stay in, may I use your toilet paper? may I use your water? Yeah, I mean, it gets absurd after a while, okay? Now, the question came, what to do if you find money? So, I've been noticing there's been a penny downstairs on the shoe rack for a while, hasn't there? Yeah. And nobody's done anything with it. I asked Heather to bring it up here so it's here for tonight's teachings. Now, did Heather steal it, or did I steal it by asking her to take it from downstairs up here?
Hmm? It depends on what you plan to do with it afterwards.
Well, is there the motivation to take it and claim it as mine? Or on her part, was there the motivation to take it and claim it as hers? No. Isn't the motivation key to a complete act of stealing? If there's no motivation to claim it for yourself, there's no stealing. Yeah, she's moving it from one place to another. Okay. Now, we have this penny, so what are we going to do? Are we going to leave it here? Are we going to put it down there? Is it going to stay there for three countless great years? You know, with people coming in and looking, oh, it's actually a Canadian penny. Is it? Oh, it feels light. It's
very funny.
No, it looks like some kind of, no, what is it? I can't see. It says 1 cent. Is this Canadian? Or is it?
It doesn't have Queen Elizabeth on it.
Or is that like, is that Abe Lincoln?
I need some glasses. I think it's an American penny, but I might be American
penny. It's very light. Yeah, it's usually our pennies are heavier. Are the new, do they even make pennies anymore?
Yes.
They do?
There's a debate about that too. Yeah. Because they cost more than they're worth.
Oh. pennies cost more than they're worth. Yeah. So what did they decide they're making
them? I think they're still talking about it. A lot of people want to get rid of them.
Yeah.
But it means a lot of change, so.
Right. And there should be a date on it somewhere. Anybody have good eyes?
Yeah.
Okay. So what are we going to do with this penny?
2011,
okay. So we can't keep it because it's not ours. Yeah. Do we put it in our, we're about to send out a newsletter. Do we say, did anybody leave a penny in the foyer? Now, if somebody had left a $50 bill, I would, you know, hang on to it and wait for somebody to come, or maybe say, did, you know, somebody lose some money here, not stating how much, but, you know, to let the owner claim it. But what do we do with one penny?
Well, the fact that it's been there for so long,
yeah.
Everyone here has had a chance to pick it up.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So can't we just offer it to the owner?
Yeah. So it seems to not have an owner, because everybody's had a chance to claim it if it was theirs. So should we offer it to the Abbey? What do you think?
There's not enough value for the law to come and put you in jail.
That's true. It's not, you know, another criteria that being stealing is it has to be something that the law of the land would get involved in, and I don't think they're gonna do that for a penny. Should we give it to another charity? Why do we keep it for the Abbey? Maybe it's best to give it to another charity.
You wouldn't want to be bothered.
Okay. So, yes?
Well, grocery stores have a little tray that says, you know, you can put your penny in there. If somebody needs it, then they can.
Oh, yeah. Right. For somebody else who needs change. You want to take it and put it in your local grocery store? Does everybody agree? Do we have community agreement on this?
I'm sure that the homeless people that go near my grocery store that I would appreciate it a lot.
Good. May they always have what they need. Everybody agree? Yes.
So how much in this country would it have to be worth for the law to get involved?
Well, you have to, you know, I can't answer that question.
But even with the law not getting involved, something could be worth less than the law getting involved, but the owner might still be upset. And so it might not be complete karma, but it might lead to disharmony.
Yeah, I would assume if it's something that of great value to the owner, like, you know, the toothbrush your mother used when she was 14 that you save, you know, because your mother's dead now and it reminds you of your mother and it's, you know, one of those old toothbrushes, so it means a lot to you. It's a sentimental object. And somebody took that toothbrush, you know, that then, you know, that might be an act of stealing. Okay, I mean, you know, because it's quite a valuable, sentimental thing to somebody. Okay, so just think about those things a little bit, okay? And it's not like I can make the decision and tell it to everybody, and it's the right decision. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. So we were at the Bright Hill Temple, and they had a Bodhi tree, and somebody had picked up some of the leaves. It was another person who was, they weren't a resident of the temple. They were a visitor, like I was. And they gave me the leaves. And I was hesitant to accept them Because, you know, Bodhi tree leaves at a Buddhist temple, you know, are a sought after object. And I thought that the temple itself might collect the leaves and do something with them. And so I was quite reluctant to take them. How did it end? I can't remember.
So you told me to ask the temple if the leaf belonged to them, if it was okay for you to take it.
That's right, yeah. So I asked her to ask the temple, because they're the owners of the leaves, if it was okay for me to have them. And they said yes. So. Okay. So we can't assume that just because some, you know, if it was any other leaf, it's probably no big deal. But a Bodhi tree leaf at a Buddhist temple, they could well be saving them and doing something with them. Yeah. Okay. So we've talked about the first three paths of non-virtuous karma, which are the three that are done physically. Okay, so now we're going to start the four that are done verbally. When it says verbally, it doesn't mean that you necessarily have to be speaking. It can also, all these can be done through writing, or, you know, exercising your tongue, your thumbs, or, you know, through sign language or through gestures. So anything that involves communication is said to be, you know, karma of speech, but it doesn't mean you have to be talking for all of them. It means, you know, karma of communication. Okay, so the heaviest of the four ones of speech is, of course, lying. Yeah, and so lying is denying something we know to be true, or saying something is true that we know isn't true. Okay, so it's knowingly misleading others. You know, on purpose, giving bad advice or bad teachers. And it's done with a motivation, a self-serving motivation. Okay? So, but let's first do the object. So the object, you know, that we're lying to has to be a human being other than ourselves. We already lie a lot to ourselves. Okay? You know, in fact, most of our self-talk is lies. You know, what a disaster I am. I can't do anything right. I botch everything up. All of that's a bunch of lies. But that's not counting here. It has to be another human being. Okay. Now, I wonder about if you're trying to lie to an animal, you know, making it, you know, like we shake the food to get the cat to come. Yeah, but we do give the cat food. Yeah, the message is we're gonna give you food. We do give it food, okay. But to be an actual act of caring, it has to be a human being. I mean lying, it has to be a human being. Although, I suppose we can lie to animals, can't we? Huh?
Some animals understand to eat words.
Yeah. Okay, so it includes little white lies, and it includes huge, you know, big lies, to the whole range. The worst kind of lie is to lie about spiritual attainments. And this means, it doesn't mean saying you don't have a realization when you do. It's not talking about that. It's saying you do have some realization when you don't. So why is that so bad? Because if you lie and people believe you, when they find out that you lied, they not only lose faith in you as a practitioner, but they lose faith in the Dharma, because you're a representative from the Dharma. So it's quite interesting in our monastic precepts, the story behind the lying one, yeah, It's very telling what the story is, because it was at a time when there was a famine in the place where these monks were, so they weren't getting any alms. So in order to get alms, what they did is they talked about their spiritual attainments, but of course they didn't have any. They were lying about them. So the people, out of respect for these people who they thought were very highly advanced spiritually, they gave them food that, of course, they hardly had enough to feed themselves. So after this, I think it might have happened during Varsa, and after Varsa, then the Buddha saw them and said, hey, you know, you guys look pretty good compared to, you know, what I heard was going on in that land where they had a famine. And how did that happen? And then the monks told them, and the Buddha, of course, you know, set up the precept, because what the monks did was completely, you know, unethical and very, very deceptive to people who had trust. Yeah. So even as a joke, we don't kind of, you know, say unless it's very clear to other people that we're joking. You know, it's because joking is quite interesting. Sometimes we think it's very clear to somebody that we're joking, but it's not clear to them at all, and they think we're serious. You know, I've seen incidents of that happen, and people getting really upset. And the, you know, the other person's just joking. And they thought, you know, the person who's getting upset understood that, and they didn't. So we have to be careful. Yeah. Well, I guess he would kind of say things, and we'd laugh, and then he'd go, joking. And then, well, not joking. Yeah. So, you know. Okay. So a human being other than ourselves, the worst people to lie to are bodhisattvas, our spiritual teachers, and our parents. Yeah. But it's interesting, having done a lot of EMLs and discussed this at great length, it seems like parents are one of the groups of people that people lie to the most. Do you think? Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? You know, they're one of the heaviest, you know, groups because they of the kindness they've shown us, but they're also the ones that we tend to lie to the most, okay? Why do we lie to them? Well, there can be a whole variety of reasons. One is we did something we know they're not going to like and we don't want to get in trouble. That's what it usually is when we're a kid. And then also, you know, when you're transitioning to adulthood, very often too, you don't want your parents to know what's going on because they won't like it. Or because, you know, it's like, hey, I'm an adult, mind your own business, mom and dad, so you don't want to talk about it. Okay. It's interesting in my family, there are certain situations in which I was actually told I should lie to my parents if these situations ever happened. Yeah, yes, it sounds very strange, but I'll tell you the story behind it. My family had another family that was very good friends, and the daughter in that family was a little bit younger than my parents, and the mother was a little bit older. And the daughter got a brain tumor and, of course, told her mother about it. And, of course, the mother was upset, but she wanted to know because it was her daughter and she wanted to help. My mother, in telling the story to me, you know, oh, so-and-so has a brain tumor, and she told her mother so-and-so, and I don't understand why she did that, because there's nothing her mother can do. All her mother's going to do is get upset about it. Yeah, she shouldn't have told her mother. So that was the message to me, that if anything is ever serious going on with my health, she doesn't want to know about it. I should not tell her. Yeah. And you may think it's strange, but in my family, there were I won't go into it, but truth is, there's a lot of, do your families have family secrets and family lies and, my family has plenty of them. So I think if somebody is deliberately wanting you to lie to them, you know, maybe then it's not a lie. I'm not sure. Also, because some people, you know, when they're very sick, then the family is, do we tell them that they're terminal or do we not tell them? I'm the kind of person, I like to know what's going on, you know, and I would be very upset if somebody didn't tell me because I want to know what's going on. But there are other people, that maybe don't know, don't want to know what's going on. Or, you know, the family thinks that they'll get too upset if they know it. So what do you do in that situation? Do you tell them or not tell them? What do you think, Nancy?
If I were their physician, mm-hmm. I'm their physician, then I would tell them.
So if you were their physician, you would...
My responsibility.
Yeah, as a physician, it's your responsibility. What about if you were a family member? No, it's a family member in your family, and that person would get extremely upset if they knew they were terminal.
I think there's an ethical piece of withholding information. It's unethical. It's their body, and it's their life. It's not mine to determine.
Yeah. So, saying it's an ethical thing because it's their body, so they have the right to know what's going on in their body. Yeah. But, your healthcare, what do you think?
When I worked in oncology, this came up a lot. Mm-hmm. And we would talk to the patient, tell them. And I can't ever think of any person that wasn't so relieved because on some level they knew. Mm-hmm. And they were relieved. Now they knew what it was so that they could work with it. And often it was the family trying to protect themselves from kind of accepting and the truth of what's going on.
Yeah, okay. So your experience was that you always told them and they were relieved because at some level they knew what was going on. And that the family's concerned about, let's not tell them because it'll be too hard on them, was actually the family's denial. Yeah, and you found, both of you found that it's much better for somebody to know.
My mother had an operation last year and then they cut out big pieces of intestine and nobody talks about it. Like, she's 92, so, but nobody talks about, is it cancerous, not cancerous, and basically the information I got from my uncles and all of this, she's very old, this is not so what if it is, she's not going to go through chemo.
Yeah.
And she doesn't want to know as well, so it's just business as usual, life goes on.
Okay, so in your family, it was grandma didn't want to know, and the family thought she's so old, what's the sense in telling her anyway? So these are difficult things, if somebody really doesn't want to know, and if they made that evident to you beforehand and said that they don't want to know, then do you tell them if they've already said they don't want to know? Or, these are tricky kinds of things, and it probably, when you're in the role of a doctor or a nurse, it's one kind of role, and it's much easier to tell them. It's much more difficult as a family member, not only for you to say it, for some people the family member to say it, but also for the sick person to be told by a family member. it's probably going to be easier for them to hear it from the doctor or a person in the medical staff than from a family member. Yeah. So it might be better in those kind of situations to ask the doctor or nurse to speak to the person. Yeah. My sister told me that when my mother went to the doctor, went into the hospital. She was in and out of the hospital the last few years. And she said to my mother, we all knew, was terrified of dying, totally terrified. And she said to my sister, am I going to die while they're sitting in the ER? My sister, I think, was quite skillful, you know. She didn't say, well, we don't know, let's see. You know, kind of maybe yes, maybe no. But she said, this is the place that's going to try and make you healthy. Which was true. Yeah. As it wound up, my mother did die during that hospital visit. Okay. But she did say something that was comforting to my mother that was still true at the time. Because we didn't know. Okay, so that's the object, you know, the person you're telling. Then, in terms of the attitude or the motivation, so we, first of all, we have to recognize that what we're saying is, or writing or whatever, is not true, that it doesn't accord with the truth. We actually know that. If we're mistaken and we say something that we think is true, but we later found out it's false, it's not deliberate lying, okay, because we didn't know. So we have to know it's not true. We have to have the intention to distort the truth. And then there has to be an affliction there, okay? So you can lie for many different reasons. You can lie out of attachment so that you can, you know, get a promotion or get something that ordinarily you wouldn't get. You can lie out of anger to turn people against somebody else so that you could take advantage of the situation. You could also lie to ruin somebody's reputation. That's done out of anger. You can lie out of ignorance, thinking that, oh, isn't it kind of amusing to lie? Isn't this, you know, fun and amusing or whatever it is? Okay, so there's that kind of thing going on inside the mind. And then the lying has to be, you know, saying or gesturing or writing something that's not the truth. Okay, so like I said before, the worst is about spiritual attainments. Okay, you can also lie, you know, for your own well-being and to harm others. Clearly that's non-virtuous. You can lie just in jest because you think it's kind of clever or witty. People do that to kids, yeah? I think about, this probably would maybe fall under harsh speech, but, you know, telling kids there's a boogeyman who's going to come and get them, yeah? And you know it's a lie, but you think it's kind of fun to make kids scared. Yeah. And then the completion of the action is that the other person understands you and believes you. If they don't understand, it's not complete. And even if they understand, if they don't believe you, then it's not complete. Okay? Now just because an action isn't complete doesn't mean that there's no karma created and that no result will be experienced. There's still karma created, there's still some result, but it's not a complete action that's going to bring all of the results, which we'll get into in a little bit. Okay? So if you're lying to protect somebody else's life, yeah, if the hunter's coming and saying, where are the deer? You know, do you say they're right down there? I have a precept not to lie. Yeah, the deer right there. I mean, come on, that's ridiculous, isn't it? Yeah. So in those kind of situations, you change the topic, you say something foolish, you can, you know, go like this, you know. Oh, the deer, they're all over the place. You know, there's many things you can do. Yeah.
Why didn't you just say, I'm not going to tell you? That's tell them the truth.
Yeah, exactly. You can also do that. I'm not going to tell you. Yeah. That's actually much more honest, isn't it? Yeah. Just, I'm not going to tell you. What I found very interesting is the definition of lying differs in different cultures. Yeah. And I found it living with the Chinese and living with the Tibetans that certain things that we consider a lie, they don't consider a lie. They consider being tactful and not hurting somebody else's feelings or not making somebody else lose face. But I still think it's lying. You know. But maybe in that culture not. I don't know. Maybe it depends on the culture. Hard to say. I just know when people have told these little white lies to me, you know, about small things, because they think I'm going to be hurt if they just tell me the truth, that I'm actually more hurt because they lie to me. Because to me, that's kind of insulting. It's like, what, you think I'm a baby? I can't handle the truth. Yeah, tell me the truth. I can handle it. You don't need to hide these things. But that could also be because I came from a family. You know, you're never quite sure what's under the rug. Okay. Yeah, interesting. Okay. Any questions about lying? Yeah.
Well, lying and stealing, when we're talking about, you know, lying has to be to a person or stealing has to be a certain amount to be a complete karma, we're not saying that if it was under that amount or if you were lying to an animal that it's still lying, right? It's still stealing.
That's what I said. It's not the full action because it doesn't have any, all of the branches. But that doesn't mean there's no karma created. There still is karma created.
So what about, like, when we're talking about stealing, where there was no motivation to steal, there's still karma?
That's not stealing because, I mean, if there's no motivation to claim it as your own, you see a wallet on the street, you pick it up with the intention to give it to lost and found, is that stealing the wallet? Yeah, I mean, you have to be wanting to claim it as your own, yeah, and then claiming it as your own afterwards. In that instance, you're protecting somebody else's property. You're doing something virtuous, whereas if you just left it there, yeah, that would actually be quite negligent because all their money and credit cards and stuff could get stolen. So I think we also have to be practical. Sometimes we get a little bit, you know, kind of dogmatic or too, you know, well, the rule book says like this. So, you know, or somebody left, you go somewhere and somebody's left some poisonous substance around and there's children playing there. Do you say, oh, I'm not going to move the poisonous substance because it doesn't belong to me and, you know, it belongs to somebody else and they're going to get mad if I take it. So I'll just leave it there even though there's a bunch of kids playing there, 3 and 4 year olds who are likely to pick something up. Come on. Yeah? Is that stealing if you move it? Yeah? Yeah.
I had this question last time I was here, like, you know, the turkeys, they have feathers all over the place, and people pick them up. So that's...
Feathers?
Yeah, drop their feathers, and
yeah.
People pick them up as souvenirs, and
right. Stealing. You mean here at the Abbey? Yes, the turkeys drop their feathers. They say, you know, like that monasteries don't pick up anything and take it as a souvenir. Yeah. For us, I think we would agree that we're okay if people take feathers. Yeah, everybody, yeah. If people take stones, they like, you know, because we have some of that mica in our stones and it glitters. I think we're all okay. But generally, from the side of the person who thinks these things are pretty, it's always good to ask.
On the subject of lying, what do you think about Santa Claus?
What do I think about Santa Claus? I think, like, let's get rid of Santa. You know? I mean, why do people need Santa Claus? I never had Santa Claus. Yeah? And some people say, oh, but you can't, Santa Claus, it's so our tradition, it's our family, and the children love it, and blah, blah, blah. I don't know. That's my personal opinion.
Well, I always thought it was lying, but when you look at the motivation, there's not a real bad motivation there, is there?
There's not a bad motivation telling kids about Santa Claus, but it could lead to some misunderstanding, can't it? Yeah. So, I got distracted there.
People can misunderstand.
Yeah, people can misunderstand because the child sees the, you know, mom and dad putting the gift out at midnight and then sees that Santa doesn't exist. Or what?
I find the toys in the closet.
Yeah, you find the toys in the closet. Who knows what? So, okay. Yes.
So Santa Claus was the, in my memory, was my first, you know, moral dilemma about lying, because it was obvious to me that all those things were true, that it wasn't the Santa Claus, and I was really stuck with the, you know, am I going to go along with this charade, or am I going to say, you know, this, I know this. So, you know, I don't think it's completely harmless, because I think most children are not fooled.
Yeah. But, I mean, we just have to think, why do we have these things to start with? So I'm not going to come out with a declaration, but it's like, okay. I'm much, you know, it's quite interesting when we discuss the 10 non-virtues. The things that I think are quite important are not the things people ask questions about. You know? I'm much more concerned with politics and corporations lying and executives lying. Yeah. I'm much more concerned about that. And why do, why do they get to lie and not experience result, whereas normal citizens lie and get in trouble. Okay? I'm much more concerned with those kind of lies. People always ask me, well, there's an ant in my kitchen, should I kill it? You know, I think people sometimes they forget the big, main, important things and get into the tiny details. That if you thought about it for a minute yourself, you could probably figure it out. Yeah, what do you think? Yeah, I think sometimes people are wanting me to act like God and say, that is okay, child, you can't do it. Like, come on. Give me a break. Yeah.
I think that's the beauty of these four branches. That it gives us a tool to take examples from our own life and apply it and say, well, do I have the motivation? Do I have the recognition?
Exactly. Yeah. And so that's why I'm explaining all of this. And then instead of asking me initially, think about it yourself. If you can't come up with something, then write a question. Okay? And think about, like, lying or stealing or things like that that have been real dilemmas for you. Yeah, because those are the big things we not we need to think about, yeah, the things that are really problematic in our life. So what I'm getting at is sometimes we skip over the problematic behavior to ask questions about things that really aren't so important. This is probably why most of the teachers go through these 10 non-virtues very quickly. Okay, divisive speech. So this is separating others by speaking truth or lies. So it doesn't matter. Yeah, it can be true or false. But it's causing disunity and bad feelings amongst others. Okay? So the people, the objects, are people who are friendly with each other or people who are not friendly, who already have some division and some quarrel and something going on between them. Okay, I haven't read what's... I'm not reading that, I'm reading this. Okay, the heaviest is causing a schism in the Sangha and also separating teachers, Dharma teachers, and their disciples. Okay, so this is actually something that we need to pay attention to. Yeah? I mean, this whole thing of divisive speech, because we do it so easily. Yeah? You know? We want an in with one of the people, or we don't like them being friends, or we want to stir up trouble. We do it out of jealousy. We do it out of, you know, all sorts of different motivations. And so we need to be quite careful. And also, this thing about teachers and students, you know, saying things that divide them. So one question, this I consider a serious question, is what do you do if somebody's your friend and they're following a teacher who is very controversial? What do you do? Okay? Because do you just say, hey, you shouldn't be going to that teacher, they did this and this and this, and you tell them all the whatever you've heard about that teacher? Or do you say nothing? So I asked one of my teachers about this, and this teacher always gives really excellent advice. And he said, in that kind of case, first of all, you have to see, does your friend consider that person their teacher? Or are they just going to classes but they don't really consider that person their teacher? Because it's two different situations. Okay? If they consider that person their teacher, yeah, then you don't want to divide them. Yeah. If they don't consider that person their teacher, then you can speak a little bit more freely and say things, okay? But even if the person, you know, what I usually do is if the person is not their teacher, if they're just thinking of going somewhere, or if they've been there a couple of times, I'll say, you may not know this, but this person is very controversial. And so it's good to do some investigation, as recommended in the Lam Rim books, for any teacher that, you know, you should get to know them and you should investigate and so on, and not just kind of go there and right away assume that they're your teacher. So that's what I say. I discussed it with another friend who's a nun. She doesn't say anything to them. Okay, this isn't the case when they're not yet, don't yet have that relationship form. But I know that if I were going to study with somebody who was controversial and my friend didn't tell me that, I would not be happy, you know. I think a friend should tell me. They don't need to tell me, like I don't tell people, well, if you go online and look up so-and-so, boy, you'll really get a, you know, a earful or a eyeful, or, you know, boy, the teacher's up, down, and across, no, you're doing blah, 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 blah. You know, we don't say that. That definitely stirs things up. But you just give advice. It's good to check out, you know, check out the qualities. If that person says, it's my teacher, yeah, then I don't say anything. And what my teacher said to do in these situations is still be friendly towards your friend, so that if later on your friend realizes that they've been going to Charlottenanda, that they can come back and talk to you about the situation, and that you can help talk to them and help them to still appreciate that teacher for the good they did do, and yet now know that it's time to create some separation. Okay, but when that person is not at all thinking of separation or not seeing faults, but they see them as their teacher, don't go in and start speaking badly about their Dharma teacher. Okay?
I think that makes it even more difficult for people who realize that they have found a wrong teacher, and when the friends separated from them, to take refuge in somebody else, to talk and to find a new group of people they can have trust with. And like many of the church, there was a church that is very controversial, and they had experiences that families and friends separated from them because they didn't accept them being there, and then they wanted to go out of the church and they had nobody available
to talk to. Yeah. So if you just say, oh, you're going to a teacher who's like, oh, I'll get out of here, I never want, and you cut off the friendship, that's not so good, because that person may eventually see what's going on and need somebody who they can talk to about it. Yeah. On the other hand, you don't yourself want to get involved with that group or that teacher or whatever. Yeah. Okay. More or less keep on with a divisive words. So the heaviest was causing schism in the Sangha. Why is that so bad? Because if you have the Sangha members quarreling with each other, then nobody's practicing. Yeah, it just completely turns the community upside down. And then, of course, that hurts the broader Buddhist community if the Sangha is quarreling. So you don't want to stir up anything between Sangha members. Okay, so then with the attitude or the motivation, first of all, we have to recognize the parties involved. We need to know this person and that person, and I don't want them to make up, or if they're getting along, I want them to split up. Sorry, I have the hiccups. I want to stir up some trouble. Okay. If you don't have the intention to separate them, but your speech has the effect of creating dissension, then it's not divisive speech. Yeah, it's more gossip. Okay? Like maybe you were just saying something quite casually without realizing what a sensitive topic it is between two people, and you have no intention of creating disharmony, but one person hears this and then they get really upset. Okay. So I'm not talking about the situations where we know very good and well that somebody's gonna get stirred up by something, but we just pretend like it's nothing and we just make it as an offhand comment, you know. But we know it's gonna stir the other person up. You know, that one is quite deliberate, even though it looks like we're just saying something just very offhanded. Okay, so it could be done out of attachment. You know, you're attached to one person and you want the other person, you want to break up their friendship. It could be done out of anger, you know, like you want to divide and conquer people, or out of jealousy. divisive words very often out of jealousy. It could be due to ignorance too. For example, causing disharmony among a group of non-Buddhists, because then we can convert them, or then we can, you know, do something else. So doing something out of, ignorance. Okay. Then the action is the action of causing disunity amongst friends, or preventing people who aren't getting along from reconciling. Okay. So even if something is true, okay, it's not good to say it if we know that it's going to cause one person to have bad feelings about another person. Okay? Even if it's true. Yeah. Unless we think that somebody else is in danger, and to protect them from the danger, we have to tell them something so that they separate from that person. But if it's not a dangerous situation, then even if it's true, why are we going and saying, you know, I heard what so-and-so said about you last week. You know, they said blah, 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 blah. Okay? Why are we doing that? Yeah? Sometimes we may say, oh, well, I didn't really intend to, you know, cause them to have friction. I was just telling them what somebody else said, you know, because I thought they should know it, or because I thought it was amusing. But, you know, that I would put under ignorance, you know, that we're totally spaced out, not really thinking about the effect of what we're saying on other people. Okay? So I'm not saying lie. I'm saying people put it this way. People tell me all sorts of stuff that I do not repeat to others. Yeah. Because there's no sense repeating these things to other people, because they only create disharmony. Yeah. So sometimes you hear like, oh my God, did you hear this story? You know? But you know, if it's just going to create disharmony, then why say it? Yeah. Unless you think that there's some real purpose for the person knowing what's going on. Yeah. I think Dear Abby columns get it, you know. Well, I know that my friend's husband is cheating on her. Do I tell her? Do you tell somebody that their husband or wife is cheating on them? No? I think you have to really think about it. You know, what's your motivation? What's the purpose? Yeah. Could it be damaging if you don't tell them? Could it be damaging if you do tell them? Yeah. I mean, clearly, if somebody is embezzling money, you know, and not treating somebody else fairly and cheating them, yes, you should tell that person that so-and-so's cheating and, you know, cheating you and whatever. But there's a way to say it where you speak about the action the person is doing so that that person can handle the action, but where you're not just trying to stir up trouble between people. Do you get what I mean? Yeah? Like your friend's going to some stockbroker that you know is just, you know, lies and cheats. Do you just not say anything because, well, I don't want to create disharmony? Yeah? I mean, if you have valid information, then you might say, you know, I had a friend who went to that person and was not very satisfied with the work they did, so it might be good if you checked it out. That's very different than going and saying, you know, that guy, my friend, he's totally embezzling your money. You shouldn't speak to him again. You know? I mean, how you say things also has a big impact on, and is also indicative of your motivation, too. Okay? So sometimes the speech can be very forceful, and we just open it up where all the parties are there, and we're just saying, you know, you did this and you did this, and you know, you start a quarrel between people, okay? Or you let them know what one person is doing, you know, and whatever. Another way of doing it is both people aren't there, but this one told you something, so you go to that one and say, oh, you should hear what so-and-so said about you. Okay? Or sometimes you do it very discreetly, very secretly. You know, like I was saying before, you pretend like it was just an offhand comment, but, you know, you're trying to stir up trouble. So the speech itself can be truthful or untruthful. It can be pleasant or unpleasant. But here, you know, the motivation is the same, which is to keep people at odds with each other. Yeah. And then the completion of the action is that others understand what you said and they believe it. And so they have bad feelings towards each other. Okay. But, like we were saying before, there are certain situations where maybe you have to tell somebody something that's unpleasant, that's going to create some division between them and somebody else. Because, you know, if you don't tell them, there's some danger to them in some way. Your friend's dating somebody who you know just got out of prison, you know, on an assault charge. Do you tell your friend or not tell your friend? You know, isn't it going to depend somehow on how you relate to that person now? I mean, the person that they're dating. You know, are they a threat now, or maybe they're not a threat? So maybe you don't need to say anything because the person's completely changed. Maybe you do need to say something because, you know, you've been to that person's house and you see that they have weapons around. So, you know, we have to, I think, use our smarts in some of these cases. Are we? We're going very slow here. We only did two. Any questions on this? Yeah?
How does that verse from Nagarjuna relate about lying or telling the truth? This verse that says, to speak the truth is to speak in a manner that is not deceptive. It is not what is in fact distorted by an intention. A statement is true by being of benefit to others. The other kind of statement is false and it's not beneficial. Because I heard a teacher, a well-known teacher, giving a talk at a university here, and I thought, oh, we're just so literal in our country. Mm-hmm. This is this thing about the Buddha teaching different ideas about self.
Right.
And he actually said, well, the Buddha was just lying. And I was like, it's never how we explain this.
Right.
And so I was just thinking, maybe he was just like talking to Westerners that were so literal and wanted to like frame this to make them think, you know, mm-hmm. But it really kind of shook me.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking to ask, like, to me, it seems like that this makes sense.
Yes.
You can't get so literal about the words. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Nagarjuna was quite clear in Precious Garland about that, that it, in the case where sometimes the Buddha said to somebody, you know, there is a self, when, you know, they say it's not the Buddha lying, it's the Buddha being skillful, because if he told the people, you know, there's no inherently existent self, they would completely freak out, generate wrong views, create a ton of negative karma. So he tells them, yes, there's a self, but that's not his final idea. Yeah. And so he's doing that out of care and affection for the person you know, because it benefits them according to where they're at that particular time. So it's quite interesting with Nagarjuna. If something's true, but it's also damaging, then it's not completely true. Whereas if it's not literally true, but it's actually said to benefit the other person, then it's okay. Now, of course, we plug in, you know, like in our recent discussion about what you say to people who are dying, we plug in, well, when it's really us feeling uncomfortable telling somebody they're terminal, we say, well, they don't want to hear it. Yeah. So there's, you know, we have to be careful of those things where we fudge the truth, not really because it's skillful or because of the other person, but because of, we've, you know, to satisfy some ourselves. Okay. But yeah, he really emphasizes it has to be beneficial.
What verse number is that?
I think it was 135 close to.
This is reminding me when I was working in government, what I struggled a lot with was sometimes you have a policy and then we would say, we're going to tell everyone we're doing it because of this. If not, it will annoy country X or Y in the nation's interest. But internally, we all know why we're doing it.
Yes.
I couldn't sleep.
Yeah.
It was really hard.
Okay, so this is, you know, typical in politics. We all know that we're doing something for X reason, but we say it's done for Y reason, so that you don't upset some other country or some other thing. Yeah. So then you have to choose if you like to stay in jobs that are like that. Many people, you know, tell me, my boss, you know, I have to lie in my job, otherwise he'll get fired. And I say, your boss tells you directly you have to lie? They say, well, no, it's not directly, but they make it known to me that, you know, closing the deal is more important than anything else. And I say, then you have to decide if you really want to keep working for that company. Yeah? Do you want to work for a company where, you know, management tells you to lie? And then, you know, you have to think about it. Then, you know, there's no easy solution. See, people often come to me, they want an easy solution. I don't have one. Yeah. They say, but it's my job. Yeah, I know. So, you know, you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. But think, at the end of the day, you know, how you're going to feel better. Are you going to feel better having the job, or are you going to feel better knowing you act with integrity? And then you decide. Yeah?
So, relating this to karmic results, mm-hmm. So you talked about it a little bit the other day, but, you know, I was reading a Dharma text today, and frequently, and I thought, oh, this is really great, you know, I'm reading along, and then all of a sudden it starts to drop into, if you do this thing, then these specific things happen,
yeah.
You know, like some description of the hell realm or whatever, and I just, you know, I kind of drew back for a minute, I go, what? You know, I just don't know how to relate to the text reading that, even though, do I put it in the mythical? Where do I just don't know where to put that.
Okay. So you're reading along, the karma makes sense, it sounds really good, until they start to give some specific things, and then you start to feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So why do you feel uncomfortable? Is it because you do those actions?
It's because they're so specific to the action, the result is so specific.
Okay.
And then it's like in the hell realm, how do they come up with this particular result?
Okay, so it's coming, it's a very specific action. And
if you do this, then you're going to end up being chopped in little pieces.
Little pieces in the hell realm or something like that. Yeah, so those kind of things, you know, I don't know if you need to take it, you know, okay, if you do that, then this particular hell realm is going to apply, you know. I don't know if that way of taking it is necessary. I think the way of taking it is of, oh, that's an action I should avoid, is much better. Yeah? Rather than going crazy, like, how did they get that? How do we know it's that hell realm? How do we know it's not just rebirth as a hungry ghost? These are the things that only Buddha really knows. So the point of the text is, think twice before you do that action. So I think it's better if we take it on that level. It's getting pointed out to me about what are specific actions that I should avoid. Not that it's, I don't need to get confused about, well, how do I know that it's that exact result?
So that makes a lot of sense to me to look at it like only the Buddha would really know what the actual karmic result is. Where this came up from,
it depends whose book you're reading it from. Are you reading it from a sutra? Are you reading it from, you know? I mean, you have to see what the text is. There's all these things, you know, that with scripture, there's things that you go through. Tests that you go through to see if a scripture is reliable. Yeah? And so you have to ask, does the scripture, when it talks about evident phenomena that we know through our senses, is it correct or is it false? When the scripture talks about slightly hidden phenomena, you know, that can only be known by reasoning, does it describe them correctly or incorrectly? Yeah. And then third, does the scripture contradict itself one part to the other? So it's not like every scripture you have to believe, yeah? But you go through and you test the scripture in this way as best as you can. Yeah, and you see who wrote it, and you see what the context is. Because, for example, with the Jataka tales, yeah, when you read the Jataka tales, you know, they're going on a ship, and they're looking for the wish-fulfilling jewel, and, you know, they bring back these wish-fulfilling jewels. And, I mean, the whole story doesn't sound, you know, we're not so sure if we believe in wish-fulfilling jewels to start with. Yeah, so I take these stories as, you know, the important part isn't, are they literally true? The important part is showing the dynamics of the person's mind. And if I can learn something from learning about the dynamics of that person's mind, that helps me choose what I do and what I don't do more wisely, then that's good. But I don't feel like I have to believe in wish-fulfilling jewels and whales that talk and, you know, demons that dance. You know, I don't feel like I have to believe in all of that stuff in order to get the message of what the story's telling. Okay? On the other hand, if you read a text like The Wheel of Sharp Weapons, yeah, there, when he talks about if you act in certain ways, you get these results, it really makes a lot of sense because you can. There's a way of seeing. How many of you read that text? Yeah. Have you found it helpful? Because the results and the causes, you can see a link between them. Yeah. And so that makes it much easier to kind of accept. Does that help?
Yeah, hearing you just say, think about what you're reading.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't feel any pressure that I have to take everything literally. You know, my philosophy is, how can this story benefit me? not do I have to take it literally? Okay, because something that will come up in Nagarjuna as we're going on is there's one verse where it talks about Nagarjuna giving away maidens and all the things to support them. And depending on how you read it, it could sound, you know, I mean, I took it as there's women who want to get married and the king is in charge of them. He's giving, you know, and that in their culture was okay, and he's giving a dowry to make sure they're supported, you know. So I don't take it as, you know, he's giving them away as prostitutes, you know. There's other stories in the scriptures where they talk about, you know, the Buddha in a previous life, he gave away his wife, he gave away his children, you know. We read that story and we go, he gave away his wife, he gave away his children. This is, you know, human rights violation, this is child abuse. How can they tell a story and say that this was a good thing to do and praise the Buddha for being generous when he's seeing his family members as chattels, as his own personal property? You know, what kind of story is this? And people get really upset about it. Okay, that kind of story, you know, I was one of somebody who got real upset about it. Now I just read, it's like, this is a story from ancient India, you know, where that's the way they treated women, that's the way they saw children. I don't agree with it. Certainly if that kind of situation arose nowadays, I would say something about it. But they're telling a story about ancient India, and he's giving his wife and kids away to a demon in the forest. I don't even know if I believe in demons in forests. But the point of the story is, when you're really a bodhisattva, you're not attached to anything. So it doesn't mean that he's disregarding his wife and he hates his children and he's giving them to a demon to eat and, you know, how can we say that's good? What is the purpose of the story is, not, you know, when you're really a bodhisattva, you don't cling on to anything or anyone. You know, you have complete equanimity. Yeah. The point of the story isn't that you consider other people your property and you start giving them away. Yeah, that's not the point of the story. So let me look, take all the, you know, this story has cultural baggage in it. Let me look at what the point of the story is and focus on that and leave the cultural baggage aside, you know. Because I know in my culture, yeah, I mean, wives are not the property of their husbands and children aren't, and you don't just do this kind of thing. And if somebody tried to do it, then you speak up and you say something, because it's not an act of generosity in our culture. Okay, make some sense? Okay. Okay. We only did two of them. How many more nights do I have to go through this? There, I was joking. It's a pleasure to teach.
Some things we just can't hear enough.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practiced it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable. their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of those false teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds always increase.
This merit
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds
of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially Akshara Bhakti